Hi, I'm Jan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am the Jan from Spokane. Used to be part of Jan and Fran from Spokane, but my husband Fran, my dear love, passed away about a little over a year and a half ago. So you're getting the first Jan without Fran from Spokane. Sorry, tonight. But he will be part of it because he was part of my life and my drinking and my sobriety. I can't help but include him. But first, I want to say some of my favorite people are here. I'm overwhelmed by all the love and kindness I've been shown this weekend. But if some of you have heard my story and want to leave, that's okay. I mean, the recovered part of me will understand. The alcoholic part of me will track you down and want to know what it was. But I do have that feeling that when I look out at all of you, from the moment I got here and Michelle met my plane and brought me here, and then I was so happy to see Mary Jane, whom I've known for a long time, and to meet the famous Tommy, whom I've heard about, and everybody would always say, oh, you know Tommy, and I'd say, no. Oh, yes, you do. And I'd, no, I don't, but now I do. So I'm very happy about that. Today I got a gift basket. It delivered to my room. I thought it was like a fruit basket, but I opened it up, and it was an alcoholic basket. It was chocolate and cookies and caffeine. It was great. All the things we need to keep going. And so I thank Nancy and Bobby. I think they were responsible for that. And, you know, the amazing thing is that we do so many little things for each other, the getting out of self. And it's really apparent at something like this. I was sitting in the meeting earlier today, and I was warm. And someone who's out there, some beautiful young woman, looked across the room and mouthed to me, is it too hot in here? And I said, yes. And she got the heat turned down. And then someone else turned a chair around for me that I was having difficulty with. And it's, you know, it's like not being so absorbed in ourselves that we can see what might be needed and doing it without a big fuss. You know, I did things, but it was always with a fuss and always, you know, to get attention and thank yous. And the people I've met this weekend are just constantly doing for each other in this humble, loving way, these random acts of kindness, and I love that. I was stunned when Bob called Spokane and asked me to come, because it had been several years since he'd heard me, and I hadn't really done a lot of speaking since Fran's death, and so I was sort of thinking as he's talking, can I do this? Do I want to do this? Is this the right thing to do? And I said, well, when would I come? And he said, well, you probably would want to fly on Thursday. That's November 11th, and that's Fran's birthday. And I said, I'm there. You know, it was just meant to be of how I would spend his birthday this year with all of you. So I thank you for that. As I'm flying across the country, I'm thinking, Fran, this is good. This is very good. And I know that he would be so pleased. You, as an area, or you know, and as a region, I mean, I know I'm in nerd land, you know. I've only been here once before, so, and you're famous, you know, throughout the AA world. And so it's very interesting, but you really celebrate old-timers. In the Washington area, in fact, we have some who don't even want to be called old-timers. They want to be called long-termers. And so we do that. But you have a parade. I mean, gee, with a trumpet, and the saints come marching in. I mean, that is big time. So I am going to take that back to the Washington area. And we're having a parade next time of old-timers because although we hear in AA that the newcomer is the most important person, for me it was seeing people who had years of sobriety and were still happy and coming to meetings and laughing and joking and having a life. And that was the attraction for me. And so I celebrate you for doing that. I think that's just very important. We have a hard time getting long-termers, old-timers to participate. We are also a split area, as you may know. I'm from Area 92, which is getting very high on the charts, you know. We split Eastern and Western Washington. Those of you who went to Seattle for the International know that the Cascade Mountains run through the state. So we had a lengthy discussion. We applied to the conference several years to become split. I have to tell you that I was not particularly an advocate of that because Seattle is in one area, Western Washington area. Spokane where I am, is the largest city in eastern Washington, and many of you never even heard of Spokane until tonight. Someone said, is it Spokane or Spokane? And it is. We can. It's in Spokane. So I didn't want that to happen because I loved going from the rural, smaller town part of the state to the big city for AA things. And I think it was good for the big city folks to come to the sticks every now and then to see how small town AA works. And also, financially, it would mean that one area was going to be very wealthy and the other area is going to be very poor. And that is what has happened. We're just now in eastern Washington beginning to rise to the level where we can really support the services we want. So it's turned out well because we accepted it with a loving grace and we're making it work out. But it is a big wrench to have a part of yourself. It wasn't like we split so much as it was they just sort of cut us off, you know what I mean, just sort of shipped us out. This is the way we felt because we were getting the most from it, I know, because we got to go to the other side of the mountains and see that, and we had the International in Seattle. I know some of you were there, and that was wonderful. So I just mentioned that is that we're like in certain ways. We get along very well. It's beginning to come out of its paternalistic stage where Seattle looks at us and those poor kids, you know. And so we're beginning to become more on parity, but it's a big thing, and we will be seeing that in AA to come in the years ahead as we get larger and more areas wanting to split, and what that can mean for you emotionally and financially and spiritually. But it's still, I still go to the big city, and I still bring them over to the other side of the mountain so they can share their experience. But I want to tell you a little bit tonight about my drinking and my sobriety. A little about my drinking, more about my sobriety. But I was in the Midwest at the University of Missouri, this young virginal Catholic girl who'd never drunk. I didn't know much of anything. And into my life came this transfer student from California, Fran. He wore a Hawaiian shirt. He had a convertible. He drank wine from a boda. Do you remember those? Squeezed like this, you know? And he played ukulele. And so he was introduced as a transfer student, and he got up on the stage with his ukulele, and he sang, "How come you do me like you do, right at me?" That was it. You know, that was all. That was it. My life was changed forever. And so we met, and we discovered drinking. Well, I think he'd already discovered it. I was discovering it a little bit, but together we were just dynamite. I mean, we were just something else. We thought, now this is the 60s, put yourself back. There are some of you who remember those days. And it was the days of the Beat Poets, and it was that we were just too much even for ourselves. You know, we were just so slick and so sophisticated. He was getting a PhD at the University of Southern California. So we got married in the Midwest and left for California and began this life, which was to be a model for all young college graduate students. I worked, he went to school. We used to do that, remember? Putting husband through the PhD, you know? And so that's what I did, and then we drank, and we drank, and we drank, and he passed all the coursework, and we drank, and we drank, and then we went to the University of Arizona in Tucson, where he was to teach and write his dissertation, and I was to continue working. And so we loved our life. We had this little house out on the desert. If you've been to Tucson, you know the Santa Catalina mountain range is there. Well, we never saw it because we didn't pull the drapes, but I mean, it was there. Yeah, we knew it was there. And we had a little bar in the living room of this little house, which really attracted us. Two bar stools, a little bar. And I worked in the library, so I would bring home bound volumes of the National Geographic. You remember those are about this big. You bring home one under each arm. And then we would have our evening. And it was like kind of like kabuki. I mean, I think, what was it? Was it Thoreau? Like, I have traveled far in my mind. Well, see, we traveled far in our drinking, but we never went anywhere. He had a chair. I had a chair. We had a table in the middle. We each had a glass, and we had each had our bound volume of the National Geographic, which we would read and plan our trips around the world. And, of course, we didn't go anywhere except maybe to a bar, where we would lie in this very loud voice about our next cruise and our next yachting pleasure. And the trouble with that is you have to remember which bars you have lied in, you know, because when you go back, it's very embarrassing. It's like, oh, you two, I thought you were in Tahiti. Oh, trouble with the yacht. Couldn't go. So, I mean, my idea of having arrived was that this little combo would play Goofus every time we came in, that little song Goofus. I don't know why that song, but anyway, but the fact that we had a song which the trio played meant we had arrived. I mean, that's the way we looked at it. And so we would just sit in our little chairs at home and talk about the plans that we had. And I mean, we weren't kidding, you know. I mean, it wasn't that we were lying. We really thought we were going to do this any day now. I mean, just as soon as we kind of got organized. Now, we were married for 12 years like this. And I often think that the reason we didn't get a divorce was that we were never sober at the same time. You know, when one would be sober and think this is, we've got to go, the other would be drunk and seduce them back, you know. And so we just went on like that. And I tell you, the desert is a great place to drink. Because one day is like the next, one season is like the next. Suddenly, 5 years have gone by, you know, and nothing has changed. I mean, we're still working our way through the National Geographic. We're still drinking, and we still have our own chairs, and we didn't have an oven, you know, but I didn't discover that for 6 months till after I'd been married. I mean, it didn't come up. You know, I wasn't cooking. My sister just sent me a dish towel which says, I don't even butter my bread. I consider that cooking. And I thought, okay, that's good, that's very good. Well, in any case, I'm there in this little house with no oven, and but this great bar, and these terrible ice cube trays. I think of those, do you remember those metal ones that just, you had to have strength to open those suckers, you know what I mean? And I opened just like one too many of those, and I just bought a refrigerator that makes ice cubes, and I mean, I am so thrilled. My daughter put it on my cell phone, the picture of this ice cube refrigerator. You know, it's just a big thing to me. I'm sick of opening ice cube trays. But in any case, at that point, I'm working at the library, Fran is teaching in the English department, and one day I'm at work and he called. And his call was to this effect. I'm floating around the house, and the only thing that keeps me from hitting the ceiling is that I can grab hold of the bar underside. That kind of keeps me stable. And so I'm saying, yeah. And he said, so I've called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've asked them to send someone over to talk to us. Now, it was the us. It was the pronoun that got me. Like, I'm not floating around the kitchen, you know. I'm okay. And I said, you know, and I'm very upset. I mean, I am genuinely upset. And he said, no, it's okay. I didn't give them my real name. And I said, well, did you give them your real address? And he said, yeah. And someone's coming about 5 o'clock. Well, I'm just torn because, I mean, it's like, God, haven't I done enough? You know, I mean, I have, you know, created this wonderful life. My theory was that most men go out to drink because their wives are unreasonable and won't drink with them. So I created this little bar atmosphere at home with the candles and the bar stool. He never had to leave. We could just drink together. And now suddenly he's invited someone else to the party, like Ray Milland or someone. You know, this is the way I envisioned it. So I told the boss I had to go home. It was an emergency. And I had quit driving. We had a new little Volkswagen sedan, but I knew you shouldn't drive and drink, and so I didn't drive anymore. And so I had to call a cab at this time of day. So I called a cab and had it stop at the liquor store because I figured this calls for big time booze. Usually what I like to drink were Boilermakers, and so I knew exactly how much it was for a pint of Hiram Walker's 10 High and a six-pack, and that was the drink of choice. But I thought this night called for scotch. I mean, this is a big-time night. And so I got the bottle of scotch, got home. Fran, by this time, has managed to levitate into a chair, and he's sitting there. And so I'm doing my usual thing. Now, the last time I mentioned this, there were women in the audience who did not know who I was talking about. But looking at this audience, I think you will remember Loretta Young. Okay, well, this was a young women's group, and they were like, Loretta who? And I'm like, oh, dear God. But anyway, Loretta Young used to have these hostess gowns that were velvet on the top and satin skirts, and she'd come squishing down the stairway, you know. I had one of those, and so I put that on. Well, that's what this called for. So I got on my Loretta Young gown. I put the dishes under the bed and wherever they would go, the dirty dishes, anywhere. I lit candles, incense, got the two scotches, and I'm ready for this person. And when he came, and he's now deceased, Paul, our wonderful sponsor and 12-step person, he had thought he was coming to see somebody called Jim. And when I opened the door, he said, two for the price of one. You know, Looking at me, he knew somehow my Loretta Young outfit had not fooled him. And so his first words to me were, "I'm Paul, where did you hide your drink?" And I said, "In the closet, like, doesn't everyone, you know?" And he said, "Well, why don't you get it?" And I'm like, no, it's all right. He said, "No, really, why don't you get your drink?" So I got our drinks and we sat down and he proceeded to tell us his story. And I thought it was the most hilarious thing I had ever heard. I had never heard anyone talk honestly about drinking, you know? And I was just fascinated. Now, you've got to understand the kind of snob that I was at that time, in that I'm figuring out, is he worth listening to, number one? I mean, what are his credentials to come in here and tell me this? Well, he was an English professor. He was a retired military major, colonel something. He was rich, very rich. He had a swimming pool. He was Catholic. He measured up. He was okay. So I listened to him, and he told us his story. And then abruptly, he stood up. And he said, "Well, kids," I mean, this was some years ago, you know, he said, "Well, kids, I got to go now. I'll talk to you tomorrow." And we're like, wait, I mean, don't go. I mean, you haven't asked about us. You don't know about us. He said, "I know everything about you." He said, "I take one look at you, and I know everything there is to know about you." And he said, "So I'm leaving you the literature." Well, this was 1968. There was about this much literature then. The big book, the 12 and 12, some pamphlets, I don't remember what else, but it was not a big stack. That was the stack. He said, "I'll leave these for you. You look them over, and I'll call you tomorrow, and we'll decide about going to a meeting." And so we said, "Oh, yeah, we want to go to a meeting. We definitely do." And he said, "Well, the only thing is, you have to be sober." And we said, "Oh, that's no problem." "No problem. We'll be sober." Okay. So he left. So we got the rest of the scotch and the big book, and we sat down and polished off both, you know, finished both. And we're like, "Oh, this is really you. Read this chapter. This is so good." And then it's like, "Oh, read this one. Read to wives, you know, and read this." So we're passing the book and the scotch back and forth. And eventually we finished the scotch and we finished all the literature and we passed out. Now, this was not uncommon for me. I passed out so many nights in the bathroom that I had these little creases on my cheek from the tile, you know. And I'd wake up in the morning like this. So I carpeted the bathroom so it would be really nice. You know? But I'm all squishy then. So we passed out. Now, what was unusual was the next morning, we did not talk about this. Now, if you think I'm verbal, you should have heard Fran. He talks twice as fast and is twice as good. And we talked about everything, but we did not talk about what had happened the night before. And I can only think that we were afraid we would jinx it or ruin it or somehow spoil it. It was like, let's not talk this to death. We had the ability to put down everything, you know, and so let's not do that. We just said, "Well, what should we do? Should we go tonight?" "Yeah, I think so." "Okay." And that was kind of how we left it. Well, of course, as the day wore on, it got to be a worse and worse idea to be sober. And we had this little ritual that Fran was in the English department and I was in the library. And he could drive to the library where I would be waiting, hop in the car, drive a block and a half to this bar where we could have two martinis and a sandwich and be back at work by 1 o'clock. I mean, we had this figured out. Well, that day he didn't come. You know, I'm standing, I'm waiting, finally it dawned on me, we're not going to make it, he's not going to come. I wasn't going to drink, I was just going to have a sandwich, this is what I told myself. But anyway, he didn't come, and then he called and said, "Well, I decided not to go to lunch, I'm busy." "Good, okay, fine, see you tonight, okay, fine." You know, so we went to our first meeting, which was in a Buddhist church. Now, that really upset me, because I thought I had joined a cult unknowingly. You know, I didn't know everything was Oriental, and I'm Catholic, and I'm looking around, but they never mentioned Buddha, ever. So I thought, well, okay, it's all right. And so they read, "If you want what we have, and are willing to go to any lengths to get it." And I looked around, yes, I wanted what you had, your necklace, you know, your suit, your husband, you know, I mean, I was going around the room, yes, this looked good. I spent the whole time checking everyone out, especially the women, what they were wearing and the jewelry. And I had worn this necklace that was like 7 strands, and I got my hand caught in it, you know, and I couldn't get it undone, and I'm hungover, my head is aching, and I'm in a Buddhist place, and I'm just like, oh, what have I done? This is bad. But I didn't say anything, and so we went home. Since then, I've heard a young woman say, and I asked her if I could use it. She said, "My first year in AA was characterized by what I was like, what happened, and what I wore." And I thought, that's very good. That is very good. Yeah, that's okay. I understand that totally. So, in any case, This is what happened. We just went on every day. Paul came at night, took us to a meeting. We talked. Now, when Fran read the big book, and someone last night referred to this, he was struck sober. I mean, he read that book, and suddenly his life made sense. It was like he wasn't a moral leper. He really liked, you know, Dr. Silkworth. He liked all of this, that this was an illness. And he thought it all made perfect sense. And he was, you know, for a guy who really loved quantum physics and everything, he thought the big book was just this miraculous plan for life. So he's off. He's gone. He's happy. He's just grinning from ear to ear. He's loving it. He's got jaundice, but he's loving everything else. You know, I went to the doctor with him, and the doctor says, Mrs. Polly, didn't you ever notice that your husband's skin is yellow and that he has no whites in his eyes? And I'm looking at him like, you're right. Oh, I mean, this had happened slowly over a period of time, and I hadn't looked that closely. But in any case, that's what we did, and he was just a happy camper. I mean, he loved it all. I, on the other hand, who only drank to be the perfect wife, was having a problem because I thought, well, okay, if he doesn't want to drink anymore, that's fine with me. I mean, it doesn't matter, whatever. But I found it did matter a lot. Now, I stayed sober, but I have to think that that was a grace that came to me, just a power greater than myself that kept me sober until I wanted to be sober. I don't know how that happened, but somehow I managed. I was not happy, but I managed. I cried a lot. I cried for 6 months. I used to walk around the wading pool part of Paul's pool and cry. And Fran would say, is she going to be okay? He'd say, oh, yeah, just let her cry. It's okay. And so, you know, it wasn't so much the alcoholism. It was that I thought, really, my life was over. You know, I was only 31. That seemed young to me at the time. And I thought, I mean, this is it. Like, I might as well go to a nursing home. I mean, you know, what's going to happen? This is January 31st when I got sober. My Christmas tree was still up in the desert. That tells you the shape I was in. January 31st, and I'm thinking, well, what about when Christmas comes and I can't drink? How am I going to explain that? You know, I'm worried about 11 months from now. And I just went on, and some of the older women, there weren't many women in AA, which I need to say, gives me such a thrill to see so many sober women here tonight. What? Oh, God, you look so good. I mean, what a joy. And it's just wonderful, you know. I think, you know, as alcoholic women, we were so unlovable and unlovely. At least I speak for myself. The culture tolerates a drunken man. I mean, in some ways they like them. They're kind of macho. They don't like a drunken woman. Nobody does. You know, it's like seeing your mother drunk, and that's hard, you know. So we were not particularly adorable when we came to the program, most of us. And so, but little by little, I've watched us inch up until now we are, you know, a sizable percentage of AA. And that is so great to see that and to see women in positions of service. And so I love that. And it was hard for me. I didn't understand women when I came to the program. Well, I didn't try very hard, but I didn't understand them. And I understood men, and I didn't understand women, and I didn't want to be around them. And these women in Tucson were old. I mean, this was a retirement community. And there were only 3 or 4 at the time. And they're saying things like, she can't keep coming to closed meetings if she's not going to say she's an alcoholic, you know. And Paul says, she's an alcoholic. Trust me. I've seen her drunk. Trust me. She is. And I would say things like, I'm Jan, and I want to learn more about AA. Or I'm Jan, and I'm interested in the concept of alcoholism as a disease. You know, and everybody's kind of looking at me, but they're letting me stay. And then I was asked to go to the prison in Florence, Arizona, to be with a group. Now, you do commitments here. See, that's a new word to me. I'll have to take that back. We don't call it that. We break it up, and like, you do treatment work, or you're on the H&I committee, or you're on the jail team. We don't think of it as commitments, but that's beautiful. I love that. So this was a commitment to go to the prison. And about 10 of us went, and when I got there, they asked me to read how it works. And, of course, I thought that was just cool. You know, I'm going to do that. They obviously just picked me out to read this, and it's good. And so as I'm thinking about it, and as I'm walking up to read it, it dawned on me that they expect me to say I'm an alcoholic. And what if I don't do this? What will these prisoners do? You know, will they be mad at me? Will they be upset? I mean, and what am I going to do? So I thought, well, I'll just have to say it. I mean, you know, I just will. And so I got up there, and I said, well, you know, I'm Jan, and I'm an alcoholic. And suddenly, it was like, Hosanna, the heavens opened. I mean, it was like, yeah, right. I mean, and I felt like saying to those prisoners, I mean, I really mean it. Could I say it again? I mean, it's really true. Yeah. But I didn't. I went on and read. But from that moment forward, I thought, I have an identity. I know who I am. It makes sense to me. I mean, I could accept it fully. And that was a great, great day. I just love that. Last week, I spoke at a medium security prison in Spokane, which it was about 100 men, some of them for life. But there were 100 men at an AA meeting in this huge population prison. And it was great. They had a chocolate cake the size of this table. You know, it was birthday time. And I was just looking at these men and listening to them talk about how easy it is to drink behind the walls. And I was just thinking, you know, So they said, we have a lot of Fran tapes here, but we don't have any Jan tapes. So when you come back next month, would you bring a tape? And I thought, I'm coming back next month? Well, I guess I am. Yeah, sure, I'll bring a tape. Sure. So that was a good feeling. But the first time in Florence prison when I said that, and then that kind of meant my life went forward from then on. I could know who I was. See, we used to go to meetings very early and help set up, and then we'd stay late and help clean up. And everybody would say, aren't they cute? They're the young couple. You know, they're just so darling. They love AA. No. We didn't want to be alone. We had not been alone sober. And I say that to people who've been married drunk for a long time, as we had. This is very scary. And, in fact, I think it was 3 or 4 issues ago of the Grapevine, I think it was, I can't remember exactly, I wrote an article called Marriage, Drunk, and Sober, talking about the difficulty in intimacy when you have always been drunk. And suddenly you look at this mate and you think, well, wait a minute. I mean, why was I with him for 12 years? Tell me that again, you know? Because you remember, when you're just new, that's enough. That's bad enough. You're all raw and emotional. Everything is terribly important, and you're very sensitive to any little slight. What? So in any case, I was thinking, well, okay, this is going to be very, very difficult. And it was, but we were patient with each other, and we had never had children. We used to have these great arguments over whose fault that was, you know. Fran said that all his sperm had died from alcoholic poisoning. I felt it was my inadequacy, but whatever the case, we were convinced, the doctors had convinced us that we were not going to have children. Well, this was cause for great drama on my part, great drama queen. Every Mother's Day, I'd usually end up in the emergency room, you know. But I just thought, oh, I'd be such a great mother, you know. And so then after we got sober, Paul said, well, why don't you adopt some children? And it was like, well, that's an idea. How come that didn't occur to us in 12 years, you know? But in any case, we did adopt 2 children, one year and then one the next year, Jenny, who is now 33 and has 12 years of sobriety, and Frank, my son, who's 32, and an attorney in San Diego who is a normal drinker. And I just used to watch him. The ice would melt in his glass, and the drink would get more and more watery, and I would like, drink it. God, please drink it. You know, just water away to nothing. I didn't understand that. I mean, I know people like that, but I didn't think my own son would be like that, you know, where it would be like, you offer him a drink, and he's like, well, what have you got? Well, I've got beer and wine, Coke, milk, juice. And he has to think about it, you know, and then chooses milk, you know. So I couldn't, that was just an interesting thing. But adopting those 2 children made a profound change in our AA life, as well as just our life in general. Well, maybe the most profound change for Fran was when he bought a power mower, because he thought then he was really a member of the middle class. I mean, he was no longer a poet. He was an owner of a power mower, you know, and he would love that. But when we adopted the children, we were poor. Fran was working at this point for Gonzaga University, which was a small Jesuit university in Spokane. We had been in Arizona, and they told Fran that they thought they could do without his services, considering he hadn't written a word on the dissertation in 5 years. But the thing was, he had kind of an alcoholic palsy by this time. Very hard for him to hold a pencil, to correct papers or anything. So he said, well, okay, here's an atlas, and we want to stay on the coast. We believe in the far west, the northwest. So he circled cities, starting in California, San Diego, all the way up the coast, and universities in those cities. And my job was to type the letter and ask if they had any openings in the English department, on and on. So I did that, and we sent out 52 or so letters. We got one response, one, from this place in Spokane called Gonzaga. And so Francis, Spokane guns. I never even heard of that. I mean, why did you write them? And I, of course, Miss Wright, always perfect. Well, because you had it circled. And it's like, no, I didn't. It's inland. Look, it's across the mountains. And so I said, well, just get your atlas out. So he got his atlas out, and he was trembling so hard when he did Seattle that he included Spokane. So that's why we ended up in Spokane. And it turned out to be great. We came for a year to see what the Jesuits were like and to see if this would be a good fit. And we stayed for 35, you know. So Fran ended up retiring from Gonzaga. But when we got there and we're looking around, we thought, okay, we had 6 months of sobriety when we moved, and we put everything we owned into that little 68 Volkswagen sedan, brand new when we bought it, put everything we owned, including our epileptic dog, it all fit in this sedan, so you know how much we had. And we started up, to us, the end of the world. I mean, it's practically in Canada. I mean, we were just like, oh my God, where are we going? So every hour we would stop and we would call someplace in the directory, you know, and we just say who we were, and they always thought you want to go to a meeting. We say, oh no, we're not staying. We're just passing through, wanted to say hi, just hear somebody, and they thought that was good. They'd chat a few minutes about how long they'd been sober, and we'd get back in the car and head on, days before cell phones, you know. And so we would just kind of plan our trip, and we finally got there. And in those days, all the meetings were held in an Alano club. And so we went to the Alano club. I think you call it Alano, maybe here. But anyway, we found that, and then we kind of made this big circle. We're big for making circles around what we're going to do. Made this big circle of how close we could live, how far away we could live, and be safe, you know, like if you needed to go to a meeting in 5 minutes, could you make it? So we looked at places all around there, and we found a house, and then that was great, and then we adopted Jenny, and she was great, but we were poor, and we couldn't really afford babysitters, and we didn't know anyone, and we thought, well, okay, we can't go to meetings together, so we'll just have to stop that. We'll go separate nights, and one will stay home with Jenny. So that's what we did. One drive in the Volkswagen, let the person off for the meeting, drive Jenny back home. I'm so glad we didn't have seat belts, I mean car seats in those days. You just put her in there and away we go. And so this is what we did. And so we had, well, as it turned out, it was the best thing for us that we could have done for two reasons, two major reasons. One is that when Fran was in the room, I had the tendency either to protect him with what I was saying, or to play to him, either that, and I was not myself. I was Fran's wife when I was in those meetings. And I think he felt the same way. And the other thing is that your home group, and I'm so happy with the theme of this conference, your home group has to be very personally yours. It has to be your relationship with this group of people whom you care about. And it's like an amoeba, kind of. It gets bigger and smaller and changes, but the center of the nucleus is always there. So he went to the Tuesday night beginners group, a huge meeting with a lot of treatment facility people, a lot of guys from halfway houses coming. And I went to this group, which later moved, and it looks like a women's group, but we do have several enlightened men who come every Friday night. It's different. He came on Tuesday, I went on Fridays. But you know, I just thought, and we would, because occasionally when I would go to his meeting, and on the way home he'd say, oh, did you notice Jack? I mean, he was just so good to me. Did you see the improvement? My God, isn't he growing? You know, and see, I can't see it. He seems to me like still, you know, just la-la land. But Fran has seen him every week and has watched him grow. And it's the same way with the people at my group. So it was very good for us to get our own identity. I just say that for whatever it's worth, for married couples. Being married to a sober alcoholic is a great joy and a great thrill and great fun. You speak the same language and you have the same visions of what life is all about. But I think for your AA world, it has to really be your own world. I mean, it's so huge a thing, a commitment, you know. It's like there just isn't room for both of you in the center of this, and that's our problem anyway, is that we're always in the center of things. So it worked out. In fact, I told someone earlier that, like, we'd drive home when Fran and I would go to a meeting together, and he'd say, well, I didn't know you were depressed. And I said, well, I wasn't depressed. I was just a little depressed. And he said, well, you didn't mention it. I need to know when you're depressed, you know. You told them you were depressed, but you didn't tell me you were depressed. And it's like, oh, God, yes, right. You know, but it's that kind of thing, in that I was cautious and probably now, with some years of sobriety, I wouldn't feel that way. But in the beginning, it was such a strange country that I was venturing into. You know, that's the way I looked at it. I was the kind of person who, no matter where I was, I thought there was a better party somewhere else and they hadn't invited me. That's how I went through life. No matter what I had, somebody else had something better, and I had been kind of slighted. And so it wasn't the fact that I was alcoholic so much as my dreams had not come true. You know, I grew up on all that fantasy and fiction and women's magazines, and I'd been married 12 years, and I'm supposed to be in a certain place in the world, and, you know, and I wasn't. And I didn't see how drinking, not drinking, was going to change that. So that was kind of my mood. But our sponsor never told us that service was an option. He made it sound like, okay, you quit drinking, and then this is what you do. In those days, we washed ashtrays. You know, we had a lot of those. Or we straightened chairs, or we did these things. So we started doing that. And then Fran kind of took the lead, and he was a GSR for his group, and then I was a DCM, and then on and in our area, and he became area chair and then became a delegate. And so we just went on that way, having this life, which was just astounding to us, just too good to be true. Friends and health and happiness and children who were a delight. And it was like so many miracles happening so fast. You know, I used to say until recently that nothing bad ever happened to me in AA. Things happened I didn't understand. Things happened which didn't make sense. Things happened which I didn't like, but nothing bad had happened. And I've kind of revised that a little bit since Fran's death. I mean, I'm trying to find the good in that, and I can only find that in the fact that he, until he died, lived such a happy life and was so full of enthusiasm and joy, and he didn't suffer. And so I'm trying to find that part of it, and he had great influence on many, many people. I have over 500 sympathy cards, and so I started answering them, and my daughter said, Mother, you don't have to answer those. I mean, they're sending them to you for sympathy. They don't expect an answer back. And I said, no, it's going to be a project for me. I'm going to do that, because they weren't just cards saying, sorry for your loss. They were how Fran impacted their life, what he said, what he meant. And so I will, in time, you know, I've done over 200, so you know, I've got a ways to go, but I'll do that because it I can do it in small doses. And it was a sense of, as we went through AA, we met incredible people. It was like what we'd always wanted, but we didn't know. This is where we've always wanted to be. This is who we wanted to be, but we never knew where it was. We just never knew it was just at the end of that hand. So life was great, and I don't have time tonight to tell you about Romania, but I will just say that Fran did begin AA in Romania, and the first group. When we went to Romania in 1985, he was a Fulbright professor, and there were no other alcoholics, sober or drunk, that we knew. Well, a lot of drunk, but nobody sober that we knew of, and AA didn't know of any. So we would have these little meetings in our apartment, just the two of us, and we'd tell Jenny and Frank, we're going to have a meeting, so we'd go in the other room, and then we'd argue over who's going to chair, you know. You chaired last week. No. And then we had tapes. So he'd call on me, and then he'd call on Bill, and then he'd call on Dr. Bob, and then we'd have announcements, and then, but we had this argument over whether we were a group or a meeting. Now this sounds arcane to many people, but you're in service, you understand, there's a difference. And I said we were a meeting, we're going to soon be leaving, we're not a group. And he said we were a group, this was just the beginning, it's true, it's only two members now, but it's going to grow, and it's going to get registered. And so we are a group, and we in fact are Grupa Una, which is Romanian for Group 1. I mean, nothing modest about us, you know. So that was it. Group 1 began in Timișoara, Romania. And then when we left, Jenny, Frank, and I to go home so they could graduate from high school, Fran stayed on, and that's when he met Rodica, whom some of you know as Juliet, because he wanted to keep her anonymity when he met her. And they said, oh, it was so like Fran, he would call her Juliet, and then it could be Romania and Juliet. I said, oh, no, he was not thinking that. It was really. But in any case, the terrible destruction that occurred in Romania, first the assassination of Ceausescu, the dictator, and his wife, and then the country is free and doesn't know what to do with freedom. But at this time, Juliet, Rodica, actually is her real name, Rodica had met him, and she had heard him speak. He was giving a lecture on postmodern novelists. Well, nobody comes to that. I mean, what does that mean? You know, you couldn't get 10 people in the United States to go hear that. But in Romania, he got like 300 people because they were so interested in anything American. So she was in the audience. She was a school teacher. And so it was like, oh, she came to his apartment that night, and we knew our apartment was bugged. There were microphones in the light fixtures, and the whole country was just a nightmare, surrealistic voodoo. But in any case, she came in and she went like this, which meant your apartment is bugged, which he knew, and she handed him this note which said, follow me. I'm just like right out of James Bond. You know, this woman comes in a trench coat and says, follow me. Well, he followed her. I mean, he is truly the last innocent in the world. You know, he followed her, and she took him to her flat, which happened to be two buildings down, and there was her mama sitting there. And she said, I heard you lecture today, and there was just something I just wanted to talk to you. And he said, oh, postmodern novelist? And she said, no, I don't care about them. No, she said, there was just something about you, something, I don't know what it is. And so they sat there kind of in silence, and she said, you know, I crashed a car last year because of drinking. And his little antenna went up, and he's like, now he had not mentioned AA or drinking at all in this. And he said, wait here. So he ran home and he brought the big book back to her, and he started talking to her. She'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. She'd hardly heard of alcoholism. But as she told her life, it was the typical story. So he was thrilled to have someone to talk with. So he left the book with her and he went home. Next morning, knock, knock, early morning, she's there with the book. She said, I could only copy a third of it. May I keep it another day? And he's like, no, no, this is for you. It's a gift for you. Well, she's just overwhelmed. And she admitted readily that she was an alcoholic. Now, those of us during the day who had a chance to talk about these miracles or these strange things that happen, this woman spoke perfect English. In fact, she spoke idiomatic English. She knew slang. She taught English. She was ready to admit she was an alcoholic. She became the first sober member in Romania in Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1985, and she has been sober to this day since that first meeting. And her first thought was, oh, I know a friend who is really a bad alcoholic. We must go see her right away. You know, I mean, there's always someone worse, you know. And so then they got Vicky, who became member number 3. Well, in the course of all this, they just were totally committed. And now, today, in Romania, there are dozens of meetings, hundreds, maybe thousands of members. And it all sprang from the work of Rodica, because Fran left and came back to this country. But after Ceausescu was assassinated, we had a phone call from Rodica. And she says, it is I, Rodica. We are free. We are free now. We are no longer oppressed. She says, you know how I know? And we said, how? She said, I had a Coke and a banana in the same day. And she said, and I got on the phone and I said, get me Jan and Fran in Spokane. You know, and she said, and they did. And, you know, I'm sure she told them more. But as she's talking, it dawned on us, this is 1990, we're having the International in Seattle. She's been sober these 5 years. We say, we're going to send you the money, you're going to come to America, you're going to go to the International Convention with us in Seattle. And she said, how many people will be there? We said, well, 30,000 or so. And she said, I have never been in a meeting with more than 5 people. It's just the same, it's just the same. You hardly notice it. And so she was going to carry the flag, the Romanian flag. And we're in Seattle, we're in the kingdom waiting for the rehearsal. And she said, I hope they have the flag right. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, when the communists left, we just cut the hammer and sickle right out of the center of the flag. And I said, so what's there? She said, a hole. So I'm like, oh, dear. Now, I have the greatest faith in the world in GSO staff. I know they're incredible. But I thought, do they know enough to cut that hammer and sickle out? I doubted it. But sure enough, came the Romanian flag, and she unfurled it. They had cut the center out. They put a piece of material in. It was beautiful. So she burst into tears. And if those of you who were at the King Dome at the International in Seattle saw that flag ceremony and saw those people, and we were there with tears streaming down our faces, because there she was, the first member. She's living in America now. And in the meantime, she has translated the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for GSO into Romanian. She's translated the 12 and 12 and Living Sober. And there's so many more things I want to say to you because you're so wonderful, but I'm just going to close with that. This is a letter that she wrote that I've had copied, and it's about writing the big book. And I think what it says, she talks about the fact that they have a business meeting every week in Grupo Uno, and she reads them a page that she's translated. And she said, and I can tell from the look in their eyes if I have captured the spirit of the higher power. And she said, so they tell me about the the page that I've done, and I make corrections, and then I go home, and then the next day I do another page. And she said, I hope GSO will think it's satisfactory. So she translated it, then, as we always do, as Mary Jane knows, in AA, we got a professional translator to look it over. He couldn't believe that she had captured this nebulous concept of a higher power so beautifully in Romania, which has no words for that, because there is no God, there is no higher power, there's no one who's above them. But somehow she found the way to do that. And so I think, you know, why was she the one in that auditorium that day who heard Fran? Why was she the one who could speak English and could translate the big book and could stay sober and could bring such love to so many people around the world? Well, it's because of the miracle of AA. Why did Bob call me and say, come on Fran's birthday to be with my friends? So I always like to close with Marty Mann's thing, because it's how I try to live. When she said, you know, I'm not the woman I ought to be. I'm not the woman I want to be. But because of you, I'm not the woman I used to be. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.